Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics. Big Al's going to take just about a minute here or a half a minute. I want to introduce a new project that Dr. Birnbaum and I have instigated just this week. We are going to focus on racism in America. We're going to get various opinions from experts. We'd like your input on what these folks have to say, and we'll also obviously weigh in with our opinions. Racism is bad, but it is something that working together we can definitely eliminate. And I think that will be good for the country. I think it will eliminate an awful lot of the political tensions that we have in our environment right now. It isn't a question necessarily of Black Lives Matter, Latino Lives Matter. It's a question of all Americans matter. Frieda, take it away.
Yes, we're very honored today to have a very special guest who's been cooperating when second time we're interviewing here. His name is Hugo Bolta, and he is an author. He's in the media. He's a guest speaker, a lecturer, president of the Hall of Fame for Hispanic Journalists, the National Association, and is a recognized change agent. You know, you're credited with redefining diversity and inclusion and initiations from a problem to initiatives, from a problem to be solved and an opportunity to be realize. And this is what I've heard about you and read about you. So I just want to tell you that this is such an interesting comment, and I'd like you to tell us, what did you have in mind with that?
Well, thank you very much again for having me on your program. And I think it's great to see that you're using your platform to engage in the conversations that are being had across the country around diversity, equity, and inclusion. Stemming not only from the death of George Floyd, but I would also say COVID-19. And I think both situations have brought to the surface what is readily known, except it is in these times of crisis and thinking about COVID-19 that they become even more apparent. And that's the inequalities in many different areas and facets of our society, and in particularly systemic racism, not just in policing, but again, in other institutions, be it in government, corporate America, or other. So for me, as you mentioned, as someone that is a champion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, not only in the work that I do with the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, of which I'm the sitting president, but also in the work that I do as news director of WTTW News, the public broadcasting station here in Chicago. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are the foundation of which, at least in the work that I do as a journalist and with my team, is the foundation that assists us in being able to fulfill our responsibilities as journalists in regards to producing stories and coverage that are fair and accurate. And I think in the beginning statements, that it isn't just about Black Lives Matter and Latino Lives Matter. It's about all the lives of Americans matter. I think it's important to note that when the Black community says Black Lives Matter, it doesn't mean to say that they are excluding other lives. It's that they're saying we need to shine a light on a particular problem for our community, that we deserve the same respect, the same rights honored, the same opportunities as all other lives. And unfortunately, historically, what we've seen is that marginalized communities, people of color, are sitting in the back seat to the establishment. And statistically speaking, when you look at media, when you look at corporate America, when you look at government, it is overwhelmingly white, and in many cases, white male. So the conversations that were being had, that we're having now, are seen perhaps at times to be new conversations, or perhaps heightened awareness of those situations. But there are conversations, discussions, and debates that have been had since the beginning of that our country was born. Right, this idea of America. And even more so in moments in time when we look at the civil rights movement and moving forward. So the right conversations to be had. I applaud you for using your platform to be able to integrate different voices to this conversation, and I'm with you. It is the hope that by having these conversations, however difficult they might be at times, it is with the intention that we're all communities are moving forward for equality.
Malta, I have to tell you, what in my opinion made our country the great area that it is going way back to day one. Mistakes were made at the beginning, obviously, in terms of slavery at the time, but the basic Judeo-Christian origins that have evolved once that mistake was rectified are, in my opinion, what are making our country great. You can't get a much better source, my friend, than the Bible. And the Bible says is we are all simply created equal. Frida, you have any comments on that?
Well, yes, we're definitely all created equal. This is what America is. It's the United States is a melting pot of diversity. And that's why it's so wonderful to be speaking to you, Go, about discrimination. And haven't we all been discriminated at one time or another? Immigrants coming to America and trying to survive. So this is hitting home for all of us. And when we're talking about the police and what's going on in the violence and other countries, you know, I mean, in other states, I mean, Portland has rejected police officers from coming in. They've had about 55 days of having to have vandalism and violence in their home. Do you feel, Hugo, that defunding the police would be something that would be good? This is what we wanted to talk about. People don't trust police. There's racism, there's unfairness, there's deaths around them, and they don't want that. They want people to help them, to rehabilitate them. And there are even places where instead of going to prison, they're saying you should go to rehab centers to straighten out, because prison even keeps you locked into a situation that can be even worse than before you went in. I'd like to hear your comment on that, Hugo.
Just a real quick interjection, well, sir. We have about a minute and a half left, and then we can continue this subject in the next segment, sir. Please continue.
Sure. So, you know, to quickly tell you, I think when people say defund the police, they're really vocalizing their dissatisfaction with the system. I have members of my family and friends that are in law enforcement, and I can tell you and can vouch for them. They're upstanding, law-abiding members of the community. But it's not necessarily, so what the situation in Portland and in other areas of the country, while yes, there are individual cases that involve specific members of law enforcement, it's really about the system. And defunding the police is just one pathway that people are suggesting in order to correct and improve the system that, unfortunately, is riddled with inconsistencies in how different communities are being treated. So, in an effort to push for equality, defunding the police is one option. I would say, from my observation, reforming the police is another one. My experience has been, in any situation where you're looking to enact change, it is best to build bridges between different people that
Hugo,
have different perspectives.
We're going to be right back with Hugo Malta. Hugo is involved on the managerial level in the public broadcasting system in Chicago. Mr. Malta is the news director at WTTW Public Broadcasting in Chicago, Illinois, and it's a pleasure to have someone of his intelligence and passion to opine as a major contributor to some of our subjects that can get to be a bit emotional.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hugo, I truly appreciated your comment on the rationale behind this talk about funding the police. That isn't necessarily a hard and fast rule, as I understand what you're saying. It isn't to say let's cut the entire law enforcement budget. It's to say let's look at a way to change the way that the law enforcement agencies are operating so that more safety is involved for our people. Am I correct in that, sir?
Yes, it's in creating an atmosphere where all communities are welcomed and feel that they're equally protected under the law. And I think in order to achieve that, you need to build bridges between different people that have different opinions and engage in discussion and debate in looking to resolve the systemic problems. It's not about the individual person per se, although of course in certain circumstances that is the case. It is about overhauling the entire system, not just to say because it's broken, but because we should always be in a state of improvement. You know, retain what works, change what doesn't, and be inclusive and transparent in the process along the way.
That makes a lot of sense. I think that should be actually the first part of our news show, because if people could do that, we wouldn't have any problems today. Remember the couple that the woman was holding a gun and the husband was holding a rifle to protect their home? That is something that they're being charged with, that they did something wrong. And the question is, what were their other options? They were protecting themselves from vandalism, and we couldn't have done anything different. I mean, would you have suggested that they didn't stand in front of their house to protect themselves?
Hard for me to say, because even in media, what we're seeing is somewhat limiting. We think we know the full story based on a video that's shared in social media, but that isn't the complete picture. Not being there limits us from having the complete context of the situation. So while I would, in most cases, say it is best not to engage any situation armed, I can't tell you what they were thinking, what they were looking at, as well as the protesters that, again, from what I saw, appeared to be peacefully marching and not provoking or engaging that couple. But I think any situation, what we see in media is limiting, and we need to ask the questions. Like you did, could there have been an alternative? I'm sure there could have been an alternative to that situation and many other situations. I just think I could not responsibly comment because of the limitations that I had in just looking at a piece of video.
Hugo, I have to say that's one of the most intelligent comments that I have ever heard on what has turned into being an emotional situation. Frida, thanks for asking that question. That's a very good point, sir. You're on.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation unless you're in it. And I guess the fear factor has a big decision-making value as well. To have people standing in front of your home you don't really know could have just been something preventative. That's true. May have been nothing. That's true as well. But I'm just wondering, as you're speaking about this, this could be very politically oriented as well. Do you think it's possible that the Democrats are afraid to ask Trump for help, are afraid to take Trump's help in having police enforcement prevent all this chaos, exactly where I'm going with socialism and chaos with Biden? It's a fear factor in itself. So we have all these challenges, and they're geared towards having a certain appearance to the public and not necessarily having safety for our citizens. And that's a huge issue as well. When we hear that we need to defund policemen from doing their job because they're killing black young men, that's something that's a generalization. So I'd like to hear from you, your point of view as far as this political system we're involved with the Democrats rejecting these police officers.
Well, I think everything, unfortunately, now is political, right? If we even think about COVID-19 and wearing masks, it's something that should be led by science has turned political. And that is symptomatic of a larger problem in our political system. And I would say in the last 4 years since Donald Trump became president, from the out of the gate. And I don't necessarily, as an observer and as a journalist, I think there is as much to blame on the conservative side as there is on the liberal side. And I would even go further to say that media in certain circumstances perpetuates that divide. So unfortunately, everything's political. And even as you mentioned, asking for help in certain situations, it is often questioned as it not being in the best interest of the public, but either asking for help or not asking for help, decisions being made based on which party you are from. And that's, I think, the problem. And I think that's the dissatisfaction that we saw in 2016 in the election of Donald Trump. I think to nothing in that regard, the country has become even more divided, in most recently with the death of George Floyd, and also in the government's handling of COVID-19 at the federal, state, and local level. I think it's only going to get worse as we approach the November election. But yes, I think to answer your question, every decision, unfortunately, the public is skeptical of because of the rift in the relationship between Democrats and Republicans, which we know it has always been a tug of war, but even more so under the Trump administration. And I think that we'll see, what the public thinks in November and how they vote.
I think I have a last question. We have about a minute and a couple seconds to go. I just was wondering, as far as you're concerned, talking to you about your lecturing and your speeches and your visibility about discrimination, what has been your biggest concern that you feel needs to be impacted and changed as far as discrimination is concerned?
25 seconds, Hugo.
I think the biggest thing is the lack of inclusivity. I think a lot of people, when they talk about racism, they talk about diversity, the first thing they gravitate to is the optics. It's about gender. It's about race. It's about age. When we really need to be talking about all facets of diversity, including experience and things that are not, easily seen, like sexual orientation and ideology. I think once we start to focus on inclusion and not just diversity, then we really have a chance at eradicating some of the racism that exists systematically across all facets of our lives.
I got to tell you guys, this is one of the best interviews I've ever had on this particular subject. Hugo, thank you so very much, sir.
Thank you.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in, time for KER Politics. We are starting out with the second half of the show. We're going to devote the entire second half to a political, I don't want to use the word activist, but I'm going to officially use the word political insider. His name is Rich Higgins. Rich is going to tell us a little bit about himself. I have to say, as I mentioned in the editorial that Jimmy and I did yesterday, I'm getting very, 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 too many varies, but they're going to stay in there, no editing, concerned about what's going on in our country right now with the liberals. Jimmy, you want to let it roll now?
All right. Yeah, so Rich Higgins, he was somewhat famous, if not infamous, for a memo that he wrote in 2017 that actually got him fired from the Trump national security staff. And that memo was basically was POTUS and political warfare. It basically outlined a very interesting view of the politics and the strategies that were ongoing to undermine the president. People took it, unfortunately, took it, and many media and press outlets called it conspiracy theory. But as we go forward, we see that it's, your Rich has been vindicated with a lot of these assertions through the corruption, the politics, and the people that are involved. But what we want to do, Rich, if you can go ahead and explain, give us a little bit of your background, and then we'll get started with more details on what you think and how this went.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on, guys. I guess the simplest and cleanest way to explain it, I'm a mechanical engineer turned Army explosive specialist that became a technical expert for the Justice Department that after the Twin Towers fell down, came back into the Defense Department and spent about years working irregular warfare, information operations, special warfare type projects. Loads of the stuff that you don't really hear about. It's all classified. And I saw a lot of the issues we were having in Iraq and Afghanistan, became frustrated with the system, like many of us, and joined up with Trump in 2015 and was one of his counterterrorism advisors, was a surrogate for him at the RNC, and then later joined his administration.
And what happened then?
The short and easiest way to describe it is during the course of the transition, immediately after the election, we in the community, have contacts in the FBI and other organizations. We knew something was amiss. It was clear that what we thought was supposed to happen after election was kind of going sideways. People that we thought really, had been part of the problem, certainly had been Hillary voters, and were not aligned whatsoever with the president's agenda, were getting into the system. And then, we saw a series of concerted leaks. So as took my position on the National Security Council, I went in there with the mindset of figuring out what is going on here. And, that by this time, Flynn had been fired and set about, basically gathering information, reading what was going on, and wrote that memo, which he referenced in the intro. And the purpose of the memorandum was simply to provide for some of the political people I had met, back during the campaign, a frame, because the president, he's not a politician, he's a businessman, and he really had no context for what we were seeing. None of us did, really. What it was clear to me, having run operations or been, at least supporting operations like, trying to remove leaders like Saddam Hussein or something like that, it's clear to me that, the president was the target of a concerted information operation and campaign. We saw leaked transcripts. We saw holdovers, leaking stuff into the various media outlets. I mean, it was truly unbelievable. So the memo was written as a warning to the president that, he has to get on a war footing, if you will. This wasn't politics as usual. And after passing it up through some back channels with the campaign, the president allegedly read it. He's never confirmed that to me. And the problem, again, he's a businessman. He turned and then, he looks at H.R. McMaster and Vince Priebus and says, yeah, this memo, it's good to go. And immediately, those guys who are, in large part opposed, if not outwardly and directly opposed to what the president's, attempting to accomplish, they immediately set about a hunt for me and ran me off out of the building. I would say my feet didn't hit the ground.
Rich, I got a question for you. A couple of questions. Number one, is that memo currently, for lack of better terms, classified, or is it now open to the public?
No, it's available. Your listeners can go and take a look at it on if you go to unconstrainedanalytics.org, which is okay. A 501c3 I'm affiliated with, or you can also just go on Google. If you type in Higgins Memo NSC, you'll find it.
Okay.
You'll find it with a series of articles, a very interesting article. Some of them, looking at it just laying it out, but many of them saying, "Hey, this is conspiracy theory esque." And maybe very aggressively undermining your positions. But again, as we go forward, talk about some of these things that are that you outlined, you know, how you outlined the memo and what is happening right now that actually is being vindicated by that memo.
Well, I mean, I think you know, there's a lot of history to cover in a short radio interview. I think the two or three key points I think I would make is number one is a lot of political folks fail to understand the nature of the election in 2016. Where, you know, we had seen for years as, you know, the masses, the American people voted to put the brakes on, okay, with this ever leftward globalist drift. And so, you know, we saw the Bush administration not do anything. And then when Obama came in, we saw the Tea Party becoming even, you know, more exuberant and trying to put the brakes on. And they elected Republican majorities, ever-increasing Republican majorities for a number of years, and still the Republicans didn't stop anything. And so when it came to the first debate in the primary of 2016, when Megyn Kelly asked President Trump, or the candidate pool entirely, will you support the Republican candidate? And Trump said, no, maybe. That's when he created for himself an external political platform, you know, that basically brought the MAGA movement, the Tea Party movement, the, you know, the various segments of the conservative slash American conservative, constitutionalist conservatives, many of them actually whom migrated over from like working class Democrats, very much Reagan-esque. And so that's how he was able to win Michigan and Pennsylvania. He didn't win Michigan and Pennsylvania by, you know, bringing Republicans to the fight. So It really was a campaign about America versus this globalist uniparty monster. And, you know, he won his election, and then, you know, having come into office, he immediately, you know, makes the Faustian bargain. I think Steve Bannon called it best, the original sin of the administration was to bring in the Republican establishment to staff his administration. Meanwhile, what's going on? Well, you know, the FBI and their colleagues in the intel community, often, I think, witting, if not direct participation of sitting U.S. senators, are moving to A, prevent his election, B, screw up his transition, and C, remove him.
Hey, Rich, we got about 30 seconds before the break, and then we'll continue on with this, but go ahead and wrap it up, if you would.
And I think, you know, that the memo was written and kind of serves as a, you know, served as a red star cluster, if you will, a warning shot that I was trying to, you know, get up inside the system to the leadership so they'd realize and recognize what was actually happening around them.
Rich, so what the whole thing boils down to, before we take a break and go into the next segment, what the whole thing boils down to and what makes this so very difficult for people like you and I and Jimmy is we're talking globalism versus nationalism. Ladies and gentlemen, right back. Welcome back. Continuing our discussion with Rich Higgins, I want to just say one thing before I turn it back over to Rich and Jimmy, and that is it's very obvious right now what the situation is in terms of the political environment of our country right now. We have globalism versus nationalism, and unfortunately, the globalists include perhaps the most successful and wealthiest people in the United States, because with globalism, they and their companies stand to win more and more and more. Jimmy.
Yeah, so, you know, Rich, as you were talking through, you know, some of the specifics in your memo, some of the interesting things that I took out of it, and I think it's very, very important for our listeners to go ahead and take a look at it. Look it up, Rich Higgins, the memo, the POTUS and, POTUS and Political Warfare. Off your site from Unconstrained Analytics, and some of the other things you've written recently, The Globalists Are Coming, I thought was a very good article in American Greatness that came out just a couple of days ago as well. The basic issues that you're talking about with media, with political activists, with the DNC, with even, you know, Republicans that are intimidated by what the left has, progressive Marxist left ideology has done to shut down free speech. Very, very interesting. Your thoughts on what's happening right now across the board in the United States with these types of attempts, and where are we heading with it?
Well, I think, you can take what Kerry and Biden and numerous other folks have said about, the current events. I mean, they're talking about revolution. When they say this, they aren't joking. We have to understand that we need to believe them when they say it. I think you have a unbelievable series of events that's taken place over the past 6 months with the virus, where as they weaponized the intelligence community against the president back in 2017, 2016, you now see them weaponizing the public health system against the American public. And it's what it's done is it's allowed them to put in place population control measures. It's allowed them to put in place a whole series of, actions and policy prescriptions that would never have been tolerated in any other time. And so all of this ties back to, whether you're talking about the riots on the streets or the face masks, is this geopolitical issue that's facing us. And that geopolitical issue is really driven by the international financiers and their desire to see the emergence of China and China-like governments around the world and fulfillment of particularly the Eurasian Unification Project, what they call OBOR, the One Belt, One Road Initiative. And so the European Union, which is heavily Marxist, Turkey, which is Islamist, and now you see Iran, Pakistan, and other countries being brought in line with this greater Chinese strategy that is being backed by the international financiers. Those same international financiers, Soros, if you will, backing the street agitators here. So it's to weaken us and split us internally, because they know for OBOR to be successful, for China to rise, the United States must decline.
I have to ask one question at this moment in time, and this is a really important question. The question is, why would any American who is living in an environment of supposed freedom, why would any American support communism or serious socialism as they have in China?
I think that you have, you're now, 12 years post the election of our first overtly communist president. I mean, this there's no real question about it. I mean, I back in 2000, I couldn't believe that the American people voted for Obama. He openly talked about the fact that he was a community organizer. I mean, he was proud of it. And anybody who'd ever read Saul Alinsky knew what he was talking about as a communist community organizer. That's the full term. And so, when you've had a Marxist president, and his fellow traveler, Marxist CIA director and pseudo-Marxist FBI director, we have to think about the institutional damage these guys have done. I don't think the average American, because the other side has such a tight grip over our media, in particular our media's editorial bent, I think that the average American just doesn't really get into understanding this stuff. And so many of them find themselves to be kind of just lost. Meanwhile, the left is making a systemic effort against, four principal targets, which are the principal targets of any influence operation, if you want to take on a country: students and youth, labor, media, and elites. And so you see them going after our children through TikTok apps and others. You see them going after our school system, the teachers' unions, etc. You see them going at our media and our cultural, programs, whether it be iconic things like sports, baseball, for example, all kneeling to Black Lives Matter, an overtly Marxist organization, okay, or to international corporations who are literally paying for these Marxist groups, wittingly or not. They've so imbued the culture with this Marxist socialist orientation that to be an American in America today is to be an insurgent in your own homeland.
This, I call it the media, you get support by a very, you know, limited number of corporations that own, you know, 90% of the media, six basically. And they are embedded both in expanding markets in China and investment, as well as controlling this ideology and the animosity that was built through politics against this president. I call it authoritarian capitalism, that these corporations, they want to support it. They're willing to sacrifice for the bigger buck and expand. And I don't think many of the members of the boards, and of course, you know, many people understand the depth of the corruption that's evolved in our system right now. And I'm personally very concerned with the lack of scrutiny over some of the impacts of these types of policies that they're supporting. And of course, you know, the one thing the Obama did phenomenally was basically co-opt the U.S. information, the propaganda method, which again is exactly what a Marxist system does. And it's actually quite concerning to me, and I'm very, very worried about the young people in America not understanding any history, and then this erasing of history that is really destroying our, you know, foundations in faith and what actually we've done to help the world in order to give freedom to so many people. To me, it's very bothersome.
I think I can give you a very short example of that. I have a teenage daughter, and her 10th grade history teacher has a Antifa poster in their classroom. That's where we're at.
Rich, let me give you one other example. Rutgers University just got a very important email from one of our regular listeners. Rutgers University is now officially changing their grammar regulations in their English department to support Black Lives Matter. What's that all about?
Right. I think you see the universities are, they're one of their citadels, if you will. It is controlled and dominated high ground for them. And has been for a long time. Any semblance of a university is, as it's understood, you know, from the Latin derivation going, you know, way back into medieval Europe, that's gone. They are ideologically aligned now. I'm far more concerned, though, candidly, about the fact that what we used to see taking place in the 60s and 70s on universities is now taking place in kindergarten classes and preschool. Yeah. And, you know, once you get a child of 6 years old, you know, and they become indoctrinated into this, you know, understanding of right and wrong.
25
it's
seconds.
Very difficult, Rich, to recover.
25 seconds, sir.
Hey, what do we do about it? Very quickly.
It's really simple. The solution is to basically build a real American movement. It's a massive undertaking. But it starts with you as an individual, you know, building out in your home, your neighborhood, your city, your county, your state. It's classic sort of insurgent tactics. You know, you build
and
a small cell.
We do not have a choice. We have to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to let Rich Higgins get away. We're going to get him back on the show. He's got a very important message.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.